Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's programme, the people of Montenegro go to the polls on Sunday for their national parliamentary elections. Around 17 parties are vying for votes, but just what will the government look like? Well, that's anybody's guess. We'll be trying to get our heads around it.
Liam O'Hare stepped out of the office today for the Scottish National Party's autumn conference in Glasgow. With talk of a possible independence referendum on Scotland's response to Brexit, we'll be bringing you his report later in the programme.
Posters commissioned by the French city of Béziers' Mayor Robert Ménard, a member of the far-right National Front Party, have sparked outrage amongst human rights and anti-racism groups for their inflammatory slogan, "That's it, they're coming, the state is imposing them on us, migrants in our town centre."
As Venezuela's embattled President Nicolas Maduro is granted the power to bypass Congress in passing his new budget, we'll be asking whether this signals the slide towards dictatorship that Maduro's opponents claim it is.
And a new study shows that almost a fifth of parents regret their child's names.
All that and more over the next half hour on this Friday edition of World in Focus. The people of Montenegro will go to the polls on Sunday in national parliamentary elections. With around 17 parties vying for votes and a proportional representation voting system, it's likely to lead to another coalition government. But just what that government will look like is anybody's guess.
The current Prime Minister, Milo Djukanovic, of the Democratic Party of Socialists, heads what is considered to be one of the longest-serving regimes in Europe. Djukanovic supports joining the European Union and, quite controversially, joining NATO. Current opinion polling shows that while the majority of the population of Montenegro support joining the EU, less than 40% support NATO membership, and these two topics are likely to dominate voters' choices.
Joining us in the studio is Dr. Dejan Stjepanovic, a researcher and professor at the University of Edinburgh. Dr. Stjepanovic, thank you for joining us today. There's quite a lot of hype surrounding these elections due to the current political climate. What makes these elections so special or important?
It's hard to say that these elections are somehow different from the past elections, because we had quite a few critical junctures, if you want, in Montenegrin elections that also coincided with, let's say, things such as the independence referendum in Montenegro, the opposition against Milosevic and these sort of things. Currently, the main issues would be the NATO membership and the European Union membership. And what's characteristic for Montenegro is that probably it's one of the few countries in Europe where we have the same group of people being in power for at least the last 25 years. Some say that actually since 1945 there hasn't been any change in government in Montenegro. So yeah, all elections are very important, and these elections are also crucial also for the future of the country as well.
And current Prime Minister Milo Djukanovic, he would like to have membership of the EU and NATO. And his party, the Democratic Party of Socialists, are one of the biggest players in the elections right now. Now, polling suggests that most of the population do support EU membership, but less than 40% support NATO membership. Mm-hmm. Now, is that going to have quite a big impact on his chances if he is pro-NATO, but that doesn't seem to be where the public are?
Well, not absolutely necessarily. That could be the case and not. So the Montenegrin, one has to understand the nature of the Montenegrin polity, of the political community, which is quite divided on many aspects. And some of these cleavages used and mobilized actually and quite successfully by Djukanovic and most of the times in his favor. So it is true. If you look at some other opinion polls, for example, they relatively recently, Montenegro introduced sanctions against Russia. Montenegrin tradition or history is quite connected to Russia. There is a large amount of Russophiles in Montenegro. If you look at the percentage, the opinion polls, I think they indicate that 60% of the population actually oppose the move of the government. But still, the government enjoys, or the ruling party enjoys, substantial support. I wouldn't read too much into that. It is true that Montenegrins are quite divided on NATO, especially. There is a consensus on the European Union, but NATO is much more divisive. There are also some other opinion polls actually that suggest that there might be a equal support for NATO membership as the one for neutrality as well.
Mm-hmm. And as you were saying there, for the past 18 years, the DPS have run in coalition with other parties. Mm-hmm. This year, they're running on their own. And given the proportional representation system, is it likely that they are going to have to rely on cooperation from other smaller parties in order to form a government?
Well, that's almost a certain certainty that they will have to have a post-electoral coalition. So obviously they will rely on some smaller parties, most likely some of their previous coalition partners. Now these former coalition partners might have some stronger bargaining chips than they had previously. But the nature, as I said, of the cleavages that exist in Montenegro is such that actually DPS probably has slightly stronger coalition potential than the opposition parties. But then again, this remains to be seen in the immediate aftermath of the elections. One of the things that could happen is that the opposition agrees on some sort of short-run government simply to oust Djukanovic. But I don't see that happening. I don't see this sort of radical change happening in Montenegro all that easily.
There are accusations on both sides from the Democratic Front and from the DPS that either side is inherently corrupt and there's corruption within the elections. Now, that might not be that strange in an election for opposing parties to be criticising the other of corruption. Is there an issue of corruption within the electoral system itself?
Of course there is a chance, and there are a lot of allegations of many elections in the past being corrupt in Montenegro, in the Balkans in general, but especially in Montenegro. These were some of the reasons, or at least some of the declared reasons for the protests last year. But the problem, one of the problems is that, you know, for such a small polity, so we are talking about 650,000 inhabitants, in which, you know, every single vote counts, but literally. So you know, 100 votes or 1,000 votes, as in the independence referendum, can decide the future of the country. So we will definitely hear a lot of allegations of electoral fraud and the lack of transparency of the electoral system.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Stjepanovic, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scotland's former First Minister Alex Salmond has said that he expects a second referendum on independence within 2 years if Theresa May does not listen to the country's demands in the Brexit negotiations. He made the remarks to the assembled media outside the party's conference at the Scottish Exhibition and Conference Centre in Glasgow. Leo Mohair was there and he has more for us now.
I'm here in Glasgow with the Scottish National Party are holding their biggest ever conference at the Scottish Exhibition and Conference Centre. The party is dominant in Scotland and the arena is buzzing with confident delegates. The event started in a blaze of publicity yesterday with First Minister Nicola Sturgeon's announcement that an independence referendum bill would be published next week. But does this really mean an independence referendum is around the corner? Speaking outside the event today, former First Minister Alex Salmond says that he expects another vote within 2 years if Scotland's place in the EU is not protected.
Remember when Theresa May, within days of becoming Prime Minister, came up to Scotland, what she actually said was she would go with an agreed position across the UK, which meant that she was going to accept the legitimate views from the devolved governments. Now, they've started to roll back from that, but then that's what Tory governments tend to do. But then Nicola Sturgeon is the one politician on these islands who's clearly articulating what the UK government hasn't done to the House of Commons. That's what Scotland's position is, to protect our status as a European nation. These are matters for Nicola Sturgeon. She'll present Scotland's demands. She'll seek to represent the interests of Scottish workers, protect the Scottish economy, protect our fellow European citizens of Scotland, protect Scotland's status within the single marketplace. If these are incorporated into the UK's negotiating position, well and good. Nicola will have discharged her mandate from European elections, and if not, then I would anticipate an independence referendum in 2 years.
At the last referendum in 2014, Scotland voted to stay in the Union by 55% to 45%, and polls continued to show a narrow majority against independence. But delegates here believe Britain's vote to leave the European Union has changed the situation. An SNP member of the Scottish Parliament, Sandra White, told me that an independence referendum would have to take place before the Brexit process is over.
Certainly, having looked at it, I think we need to go before Brexit is complete. Closed door is much harder to open again. I think we have to go before the Brexit is complete. We have an opportunity, we have a door that's open to us. We need to push through that door, and the independence referendum will give us the opportunity to push through that door. So, yeah, it's got to come before the complete Brexit.
Now joined by one delegate, Gary Patterson. Gary, could you kind of sum up the atmosphere, the mood here today?
Well, I think we're meeting just in the on the back of the really shocking Tory conference that's happened in the last couple of weeks. The xenophobia and blatant racism and attack on EU citizens has been extremely shocking. So I'm really pleased that the First Minister has taken another kind of strong step towards putting a red line out there for the Prime Minister to see, and really the ball is in the Prime Minister's court.
Meanwhile, just a short walk across the River Clyde, an alternative event is taking place. Idea Space, billed as a festival of ideas, is composed of meetings on a range of subjects, including local democracy, foreign policy and economics. The event is organised by the think tank The Commonweal, and I spoke to its head of policy and research, Ben Ray, about the likelihood of a second independence referendum.
What Nicola Sturgeon's doing is positioning herself to be able to say to Theresa May, if you don't take account of our wishes, the wishes of the Scottish Government, then we have this ready to go, a referendum bill which can be utilised in such a way that whenever Nicola Sturgeon wants to use it, she can have a referendum. So she's trying to basically position herself to have the utmost flexibility to have a referendum if she wants it, and to put pressure on Theresa May to take account of her demands, but she's not necessarily going to pull the trigger.
So there's a lot of expectation here in Glasgow, almost an assumption amongst delegates that Scotland will be independent within the next few years. But there are still several obstacles in Nicola Sturgeon's path, none more so the polls that still fail to show a majority support for independence. How and when she will overcome these challenges remains to be seen. Limo here, Sputnik News, Glasgow.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Still to come on the programme, as Venezuela's embattled President Nicolas Maduro is granted the power to bypass Congress in passing his new budget, we'll be asking whether this signals the slide towards dictatorship that Maduro's opponents claim it is.
Decoding Darfur is a new innovative platform from Amnesty International. It aims to crowdsource digital decoders, allowing anyone in the world to help analyse satellite imagery in regions often impossible to access.
And a new study that shows that almost a fifth of parents regret their children's names. That's it, they're coming, is the slogan on a new poster campaign launched in the French city of Béziers. The slogan is placed above a picture showing a crowd of male refugees outside the town's cathedral, followed by, quote, "The state is imposing them on us, migrants in our town centre." The posters were commissioned by Béziers Mayor Robert Menard, a member of the far-right National Front Party, in response to the government's intentions to relocate refugees and asylum seekers to cities across France as authorities aim to close the Calais camp.
It's expected that 40 refugees would be relocated to Béziers, but Menard insists that he was not informed of this move and has said that residents should be allowed to vote on whether or not they accept them. The poster campaign has already been met with a great deal of criticism, and an investigation has now been launched by the Béziers Prosecutor's Office.
Joining us on the line is Vassar Louati, a French human rights activist. Vassar, thank you for joining us today. What was your initial reaction to this poster campaign?
I mean, the person who published this campaign, I mean, never stops. And, he's known, the same person who was counting Muslim students who were in his city. He's the same person who, not a month goes by without him targeting the Muslim community in his city. And he's a notorious racist in France. He organized a platform with the notorious far-right leaders, the identitarian leaders, in his own city. So this campaign becomes quite sickening, because he himself comes from a community of immigrants who settled in Algeria and came back to France as immigrants. For him to draw fears toward these immigrants when France itself barely accepted a few thousands when compared to Germany, just completely, you know, just unacceptable. But coming from him, honestly, I am no longer surprised by anything.
Do you think that, given his status in the town, that posters like this then make those in the town feel like xenophobia and hate crime is legitimate?
Definitely, because in France, the racist rhetoric has become even noble. Look at our presidential campaign and the way it is going with the burqa hysteria and the debates on the place of French Muslims in French society, and how nobody is speaking about mass unemployment, the corruption ruling our country. But the only thing they are focusing on is the citizenship of French Muslim citizens. But what comes as a warning sign is that nobody is speaking up against this normalized racism in France. And now we can't even speak about random events or isolated events. This is clearly a structural problem, because racism is carried by elected officials, by members of the government and members of parliament. And the same language we hear today is the same language that was used back in the 70s and 80s, where Arabs and blacks were being killed in the street and people just left and without even being judged or sentenced to go to jail. So what Robert Ménard is doing today is just, again, profiting from the fact that racism is no longer taboo in France.
There is going to be an investigation, I believe, into the posters in Béziers. Do you think that this investigation will help tackle hate crime and help tackle xenophobia, or is it kind of a empty rhetoric?
No, madam. No, we don't have an independent justice in France. Don't forget that the prosecutors depend from the government itself, and we have not seen any judiciary decision tackling firmly racism in France. So we don't expect anything. Don't hold your breath. This is just a way of saying, well, we are going to do something. They have been saying this for decades and nothing was done. And if the French government was serious about tackling racism, he would have done so a long time ago. The only campaigns we have had from the government so far to tackle racism are just communication campaigns. Hey, people, racism is evil. We don't see, for example, the enforcement of existing laws. We don't see fines being decided against those culprits. We don't see people going to jail for beating down Arabs and blacks. We only see politicians supporting one another because they are part of the same system. These problems are just systemic. They are not isolated. And we don't expect anything from the government as long as citizens themselves do not coerce the government into acting against racism. And just a study today showed that 56% of French people believe that we speak too much about Islam at the expense of speaking about mass unemployment. So these are signs that people are just sick and tired of this, ongoing debates.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yasser Louati, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The embattled Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, faces accusations this week that his administration is sliding towards a dictatorship. His opponents are furious after the country's Supreme Court ruled that Maduro's budget can now be passed without the approval of Congress. Maduro's supporters argue that the budget that will be presented to the court today has seen input from various sectors of civic society in Venezuela, and that the move is merely a pragmatic one, given the inevitability that the opposition-dominated Congress will likely do everything they can to block it.
The High Court has also referenced accusations of vote buying and a variety of alleged electoral violations from Congress and a perceived agenda of deliberate destabilisation from Maduro's opponents. The opposition, though, say that the High Court is stuffed with supporters of the president who are attempting to circumvent Venezuelan democracy.
Gabriel Hetland is a professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Albany, and he joins me on the line now from New York. Thanks for speaking with us today, Professor Hetland. Is this a shift towards dictatorship?
I don't think it's a shift towards dictatorship, although I think it is something that should be analyzed and potentially criticized. But I think the problem with a lot of mainstream coverage of what's happening in Venezuela right now is that it misses the very confrontational attitude by both sides in the conflict. So there's certainly plenty to criticize on the part of the government. They've been too slow in terms of the recall referendum. They haven't played completely fairly with the National Assembly. But the National Assembly has also taken action that can certainly be characterized characterized as hostile or even anti-democratic. They've repeatedly tried to sort of call for the overthrow of the Maduro administration. Many leading members of the opposition have for years and years sort of failed to recognize the government's legitimacy. Just a month and a half ago, the leader of the National Assembly made statements days before the big protest on September 1st, basically glorifying the 2002 coup against Hugo Chavez, and essentially saying that the only thing wrong with it was that it hadn't worked out. Other members of the opposition very recently have made statements that are not directly calling on the armed forces to intervene, but are certainly suggestive in that manner. So I don't think we should let the government off the hook. I don't think that we should say everything the government is doing is fine, that there's no problems with the government. But I think we need to have a much more balanced view that also takes into account the hostility, repeated hostility and anti-democratic actions of the opposition.
Obviously, there's little doubt that there are narratives that are being presented by both sides. But for the sake of this argument by the opposition that paint Maduro as a dictator type figure and have painted his predecessor Chavez as a dictator-type figure as well. How helpful are moves such as this, such as bypassing the Congress and effectively bypassing democracy, how helpful are they in terms of countering that narrative?
They're not the most helpful, certainly, but it's hard to sort of see any good solutions right now. I don't think there's a lot of good possibilities. There's been times that Maduro has really reached out to the opposition. So again, I want to just take it back and put it in context and then come back to the current moment. But right after December 13, there was a big municipal election that the government and the ruling party did surprisingly well in. They won well over 50% of the vote. They won like two-thirds or close to three-fourths of municipalities around the country. So it's a moment where the government had done really well, you know, almost a year after Chavez had died. And in January, Maduro sat down with Capriles and other members of the opposition for sort of peace talks, in quotes, to figure out, you know, a way to live together. They even discussed really difficult issues such as raising the price of oil, which is sort of a third rail of Venezuelan politics. So this is a really hopeful moment within Venezuelan politics relatively recently. And then literally a month and a half later, the February 2014 protests emerged in which the opposition just sort of had a full-on assault, essentially trying to commit regime change by any means necessary, not worrying at all about democratic niceties. They then won the National Assembly in December of last year, and the government recognized the victory, but did take a series of steps that I think are questionable and challenging. So I think that, you know, clearly Maduro's current actions are something that we would need to analyze and think about. But on the other hand, the opposition has taken actions not respecting the Supreme Court's decision to say that three lawmakers who had been elected in very questionable circumstances couldn't be seated. They seated them anyway, and that's why the Supreme Court at that point said that the National Assembly was essentially moot because they had opposition members who the Supreme Court didn't recognize for somewhat legitimate reasons. So certainly I think we can say that, you know, actions that are really abrupt on the part of the government are probably something we can criticize, but we always have to take into context the larger situation that's going on. And unfortunately, my government, the United States government, has often taken actions which are not supportive in any way of sort of democracy or dialogue, but really very, very blatantly anti-government, anti-regime, pro-regime change within Venezuela.
Just finally, though, to take it back to the issue of the opposition and that sort of search for a compromise. Obviously, the opposition is just that, an opposition. And so the onus surely should still be on the Maduro administration to be trying to find a compromise, however difficult that might be, given that effectively, I mean, the opposition do still represent a large proportion of Venezuelan society.
Yeah, although I really think that we can't let the opposition off the hook. I mean, when you have an opposition that is repeatedly calling for a government to be overthrown, including by violent means, saying that they're just an opposition is letting them off the hook way too easily. Certainly, we don't want to just defend the government and say that everything is hunky-dory. And I think there's a series of actions. I mean, I can point to a very concrete thing in May and June when the government was collecting signatures, and they very arbitrarily stripped about 600,000 signatures out of 2 million for an initial stage of the recall referendum. Some of those probably should have been stripped, but certainly not a third of them. So that's a clear anti-democratic action on the part of the government. But when the opposition is sort of painting itself as a totally legitimate party, that's really ignoring a lot of problematic history. And I think that we have to look that in the face It's a very difficult situation. And I think that there's been times that the government has reached out and the opposition has not been there, has not had any interest in doing that. I think the opposition's only goal right now is regime change. They haven't put any proposals forward for fixing Venezuela's economic situation. They do not have a lot of support within popular sectors. Neither does the government, certainly, but it's a really difficult situation. And I think we have to try as much as possible to maintain a balanced perspective, which means being very critical of both sides.
Well, Gabriel Hetland, thank you very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Just 2 weeks ago on World in Focus, we reported on the alleged use of chemical weapons by the Sudanese government on civilians in Darfur. The report was based on evidence gathered by human rights group Amnesty International using satellite imagery.
Now, Amnesty International have developed a new online platform to allow anyone in the world to become Amnesty decoders. The platform, Decoding Darfur, allows users to sign up to help identify villages in satellite pictures. Researchers can then make comparisons to past pictures to pinpoint areas where attacks have been made.
Malina Marin from Amnesty International joins us on the line. Malina, thank you for joining us today. We've seen the use of satellite imagery in the past in Darfur and also highlighting the plight of refugees on the Syrian-Jordanian border. How important is this advancement in technology in allowing you to study areas that are often impossible to access?
Well, of course, for us it's absolutely crucial, and we've been using satellite images now, I think, for 10 years. Especially, indeed, as you said, areas that are hard to access, governments don't let us in and don't allow any monitors or rarely any journalists in to monitor the situation. So for us, remote sensing and satellite images are fundamental for research, really, to understand what's happening on the ground. We've been using it for a long time. One of our first projects was called Eyes on Darfur. So now about 10 years later, we launched another project focused on Darfur as well, also highlighting how the situation hasn't really improved in these last 10 years and that civilians and people on the ground are still suffering from government attacks. For us, satellite images are important, fundamental for research. We have a team that is based in D.C. and Colorado that is working with researchers, helping them really make the most use of satellite images. And now the new addition we have is that we're able to cover way bigger areas by involving a large crowd. So the way we used images a lot in the past was really looking at small areas, so a neighborhood, a village. But we weren't able to cover a large area because really time and resources and the attention to detail you need to analyze a satellite image. But now having this crowd, we can really do much more than before.
Now, is this easy for anybody anywhere in the world to just come along and help out?
That's what we're hoping for, and that's what we designed it for. We want anybody to be able to be part of Amnesty International research and human rights research. And we think that using this technology, it's called microtasking, helps us split a very complex problem into very small bits that indeed anybody can contribute to. So we distribute problem solving over the internet by design and making it really accessible and really easy for anybody to use. And of course, every single contribution counts, but we also have a verification mechanism. So we're looking for consensus in the crowd. We're looking for showing the same image to multiple people and see whether they agree on the fact that there is a village or not. So we don't assume that everybody will get it right all the time. We think people have goodwill and really want to participate and, you know, read, take our tutorial and look at the examples we have and ask questions on the forum. But we also estimate a bit of a margin of error, as is normal. You can't have, and you can't expect everybody to contribute in a perfect way. But it's working out really well statistically. We have really good answers, and the crowd agrees in about 80% of the cases, as we've seen in past projects.
As you say there, scrutiny and verification of crowdsourced data is very important. Is there any concern that you might get people purposely trying to troll the site and put in false information?
Yes, and I think as we do projects that are more high profile, this will be a bigger concern. So we have manual verification as well. We have our researchers looking at the data and finding anomalies in addition to the system verification. And I think as we go along, we'll be more and more sophisticated into understanding behavior and understanding who can possibly threaten the platform and how we can prevent that. But yeah, absolutely. I think as the profile is higher, we're more susceptible to threats, of course.
Well, Malina, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Thank you so much for calling.
And finally, a new poll shows that nearly a fifth of all parents regret their children's names.
This sounds a little bit harsh.
It does, but when you look at the list of some of the names children have been given, you begin to see why. It includes Mustard M. Mustard, Lettuce, and Number 16 Bus Shelter.
Number 16, but I know, I remember the Bus Shelter story. I think they were forced to legally change that name, were they not?
I think they were, but there is one common theme among parents that don't like their children's name, though. They all blame their other halves for it.
Well, yes, I suppose that comes as no surprise. That's all we have time for, though, on this edition and this week of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we hand over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. Until Monday, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster. Goodbye.